Hello and welcome again to Food Conversations, the program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shoe Swap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shoe Swap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Today, we have a guest that is going to explain a lot about the food world in this part of British Columbia. It's Harmony Bjarnason. Harmony Bjarnason is officially the Regional Project Manager for the Climate and Agricultural Initiative BC, which is a provincial and federally funded program that you're going to hear a lot more about in our next show. But today, we're going to talk to Harmony about her trajectory to become this, to get into this position. Welcome, Harmony.
Thank you, Warren. Lovely to be here.
Delighted to have you on the show. Harmony and I have had a long conversation before the show in which I realize, as I have with every guest on this show, that people in the position they're in today weren't born in that position. They got there through life's circumstances, and Harmony's trajectory is no exception. It began in and around the world of food, and Harmony, in Kelowna, that's where you got your start in this world. You also told me that you were named after the Elton John song of the same name.
Yes.
Did that shape your life, or was that just one of those things that happened?
You know, I think, you know, the fact that my parents named me after a song certainly rings true that music was a big part of our life growing up. My family's very musical. Every gathering is full of music and instruments. So it's certainly shaped my life in a big way. I am not as musically gifted as some of the others in my family, but I'm working on it.
Every musician needs a listener. So
right?
You can play a very valuable role. And your family culture on your mother's side was Irish, English, and your father's side Icelandic.
Yes.
So you come from a bit of a mix of cultures. Is that also playing a role in the background in your life in one way or another?
Yeah, I mean, I think to a certain extent, but my family all came over to Canada many generations ago. So my great-grandfather settled in Kelowna when, there was no bridge. It was very, very small. So a lot of my upbringing in the Okanagan was, kind of that typical settler upbringing. It was, large orchard country. Everybody was in farming. Everybody was, preserving food and growing food. And that was certainly the culture that I grew up in. And how many of those traditions, carried over from generations before, I'm not sure. But certainly when I look at my upbringing, it was very much a, settled Canadian, small country upbringing.
And Kelowna was much more rural when you were growing up. You were mentioning some of the lands that you saw as orchards around you are now townhouses. It's changed quite a bit.
Dramatically. When I grew up in Kelowna, I think the population was about, 30,000. There was no grand hotel. All of downtown was just kind of undeveloped land for the most part. It's fascinating to look back at some of these pictures from the top of Knox Mountain, and there's, really nothing but a downtown strip and lots of vacant land, and that's not the case now. The elementary school I was at across the road was all orchards, as far as the eye could see, and that certainly has changed dramatically.
Your family was also involved with food in a very real way from the beginning. Your grandmother actually had a canning kitchen. Now, a canning kitchen strikes me as a very hot and steamy place when it's in operation. What was that? Do you remember that kind of setting?
Oh, yes, definitely. They had a house built when I was, probably around 10 or so. And my grandmother did so much canning because my grandfather probably grew enough vegetables up and fruit up at his tree farm to feed all of Kelowna. So she she had the, I don't know, perhaps unfortunate task of needing to preserve all of that, because that, I think probably, you know, one of those traditions they carried with them was certainly not wanting to waste food coming from, you know, Ireland during times of food shortages and so on. So all of anyone who does food preserving knows that that generally happens during the heat of the summer, when you'd rather be outside at the beach. So certainly lots of that. And then just lots of summers spent, you know, husking corn and cutting tops off beans. And, you know, all of us kids would just be given a job, and we'd sit outside and process food.
Well, that's a good place to sit outside and process food.
Yes.
Your mother's family also ran a tree nursery, but it wasn't the typical sort of forestry-related tree nursery. It was a different kind of tree nursery. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there was my grandfather's father started a company called Stewart Brothers Nurseries based in Kelowna, and they grow, so they're still in existence. The company has since changed hands between our family and actually the kind of key employees, which is really lovely that they were able to, you know, move it forward into, you know, the 21st century. But the trees that they grow are large. We call them caliper trees, which are trees that are destined to go into kind of large landscape jobs. So at this, you know, municipal districts, cities, they did sell a bunch of trees down to the Salt Lake City Olympics when that was happening back in, I don't even know, I think it was the 90s. So certainly very large trees that you need big machinery to move around.
And your
not
company,
your typical landscape tree.
And your company also, the company rather, has been in existence over 100 years, so that it won a special award for its longevity.
Yeah, it's pretty, I actually can't remember what the name of it is, but I think it's a centennial award. So you get a letter from somebody important.
Some dignitary
somewhere. The Governor
General,
perhaps. Somebody in Ottawa sends you a letter and a certificate. So we did have a big celebration. It was absolutely lovely to see the, you know, the company. It's not that common that companies start and last 100 years in Canada. So it was a pretty special event. We celebrated it. We did do a big celebration.
Okay. In addition, your own parents had a farm that grew market vegetables, mixed vegetables rather, and
yes.
you became the boss. To some degree,
I think I was like the mostly the helper. But yes, my parents, you know, it was a vegetable farm and actually a garden center as well. So they had kind of retired from their usual jobs. My mom worked as an accountant. My father worked in heavy equipment sales, and they had always had this little dream of having a garden center. But it's just so happened that the plot of land that they found was currently an operating vegetable farm. So I remember I was living in Vancouver, and they were so excited, and they called me to tell me that they'd purchased this farm and they were going to start a garden center, but that it was also a vegetable farm. And I was like, oh my goodness, do you guys even know how to farm vegetables? So the people, thankfully the people who had sold the property did stay on to help manage it for the first year. But we were busy. It was fantastic. It was, as anyone who operates a market and garden knows, it's incessant. You're constantly seeding, constantly harvesting, dealing with all different types of pests and processing requirements. So it was very intense, but absolutely lovely. Definitely some of the best years of my life.
And you worked with the public when they came to purchase?
Yeah. So we had a little farm stand. So there was an actual structure. So we did have, you know, the garden center was on one side, and when we sold all the farm produce through the store. And it was a nice compliment in that garden centers tend to be very busy in the spring. And then when it gets hot, it actually, you know, becomes more challenging to plant and keep things alive. So it was very complimentary in that when all of the seasonal produce was ready, that typically was during the summer when the garden center was a bit quieter. So it did allow us to keep, you know, our staff employed more fully throughout the season. It did make for, you know, busy days. But yeah, it was great. That was definitely, for me, one of the highlights was working the counter talking to people who came in, helping them pick out plants, helping them with recipes, all of that. I just absolutely adored it.
You told me that it was your happy place and you felt in your element. Sounds about right.
Yes.
But it wasn't enough to stop you from wanting to escape from the small town world to the big city. So in your late teens, you headed off to Vancouver and UBC. And how did that start off? And it wasn't a straightforward course when you got into studies in the big city.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly my career path has been all over the map. I've changed my mind several times about what I might want to do with my life. I think that's perhaps common these days. But I did set off to the city after high school. I couldn't wait to get out of small town Kelowna. I swore I'd never come back, but here I am all these years later. But it was great. I was just after a taste of big city living. I thought I'd move to New York or somewhere big. But you know what I realized over time, as I think a lot of us do, is that one, I think kind of like the DNA of where you grow up is kind of imprinted in you to a certain extent. I always, you know, would come back, and as much as I maybe didn't want to live here, I just had a deep appreciation for it. So
you were at that time in this heady world of moving to the big city, you were going to be a war correspondent.
Yeah, I certainly expected to go to UBC. I thought I'd pursue a degree in journalism. I wanted to, go to the conflict zones. That was my plan. When I was a kid, my mom had all of these National Geographic magazines, and I tore out all the pictures, and my entire room and ceiling was just plastered with, you know, photos of all over the world. And at that time, I mean, you know, kind of images from other parts of the world weren't as commonplace as they are today. We didn't have the internet. You saw things on TV, but it really, you know, just wasn't accessible. So for me, that was my escape and where I wanted to be. But when I got to UBC, I think a couple of years of doing an arts degree, writing a lot of papers, doing a lot of research, I realized that maybe writing was not my
your happy place.
My happy place after all. Yeah.
So instead, you went into, your degree eventually was in international relations and economics. So you went from journalism to studying the way the world works. It's like your National Geographic ceiling and walls suddenly was part of your student world.
Certainly, yeah. And I think, when you go to university, you're often exposed to courses you've never even heard of, topics you didn't know existed as fields of study. So certainly as I started taking some political science courses and particularly some courses on international relations, just kind of, you know, how the world works, what types of institutions we rely on in Western civilization or, you know, just kind of global civilization to help keep the peace, help people collaborating. I found all of that really fascinating. And that was kind of what that's the path I continued with.
While you were studying for your new interest in the world, you also kept a garden at UBC. You gardened.
Yeah, I did. I've always gardened. I started gardening in high school. I got a job at a garden center and it just, you know, resonated for life. So when we lived in Vancouver, anyone who's lived in Vancouver probably knows. So Kitsilano is the suburb closest to UBC. That's where a lot of students live. And there, it's just full of character houses with multiple suites and houses. And you often have your own door and possibly a little yard space. So we just always had a really big patio, but it was just full to the brim with flowers and food and all of that. And it was certainly something that, you know, I've started doing that about, you know, 20 years ago, and it's never stopped. Even now, I've got all these seedlings that I started. Every year I tell myself I'm only going to you know, I'm only going to grow like 20 tomatoes because I don't have a lot of space in my yard in Kelowna. And sure enough, I have about 40 on my table right now, trying to figure out where they're all going to go.
Find a home for them all. Find a home for these waifs who have found their way into your life. So after you graduated, tomatoes in hand, you thought about going to the center, the nerve center of political life in this country, Ottawa. But you said you didn't like the winters, and having lived in Montreal for 7 years, I can attest to the fact that there's quite a difference between Vancouver winters and Ottawa winters. And you liked skiing. So instead, you kind of drifted back into the journalistic realm. That happened a little bit by serendipity, as often these things are. How did that go? How did that happen?
Yeah, so when as I was completing my undergrad, I had an opportunity to go and do some work for a new radio station that had just had opened up in Vancouver. It was a very kind of edgy format, so it was a really great, fun place to go do some work. So I did that for several years, and then actually took off on a university exchange and left that work. But it really, I think I thoroughly enjoyed my time in broadcasting. And I think it certainly planted a seed for me that, you know, perhaps it wasn't going to be journalism in the traditional sense of, you know, writing, but that there were other opportunities to, and I mean, as you know, you would know as someone who is in journalism, it's really about observing the world, collecting information, you know, analyzing that and sharing it back. And I think having this new format to do that in certainly really resonated with me. So I did contemplate, I worked in broadcasting and radio for several years, including after I finished my degree, because that was, as people who do arts degrees often know, it's generally more about where your experience is as to where you go to work after university. So all of my experience was in radio at that point. And I did contemplate going into actually television. I did apply to BCIT to their television program. But at the time that I was accepted, I'd also just received a really great offer from a local radio station in Vancouver to, go work full time. So I took the easy road and I went and did that. After university, I wanted some money, right? So I had to go work.
I've, having been a student myself, I can attest to the fact that money sometimes looms large.
Yeah. And just something other than school. It was great to have something, you know, to apply myself to.
You also worked for The Beat, another program. And that was a different kind of experience, but it was also quite inspiring for you.
Yeah, it was a fantastic experience. And I mean, I think for anyone, a lot of those early jobs you have out of university are very formative. It's often, you know, kind of working in an environment where you are part of a team of people that are making things happen. You know, when you're in university, you're often just working on your own, and maybe you've got a part-time job, but you don't have that immersive experience where you're, you know, you're kind of part of the machine that's creating content. So working at The Beat was super fun. It was a lovely team of just creative individuals. It was a it was actually an independent radio station, which is a bit unusual in Canada, certainly, especially because this was a, you know, it was a major player in the local radio market. So as much as it was independent, it was still one of the top rated radio stations. So it was super fun. As anyone who's worked in, I think, radio and journalism knows, it is it is incessant. So after several years,
we definitely know that.
I did get a little burnt out. I did get a little burnt out, and I needed a break after a while.
So part of the way you got a break was that you met an Aussie and got married.
Yeah, I did. I actually met him when I was on university exchange. I'd gone off to Perth, Australia. So when you apply to university exchange, or previously, you kind of put down your top three choices. And I wanted to go to Australia, and I was planning on going to a big city because that's what I, you know, I was always very interested in the big cities. And it just so happens that my cousin had just come back from Perth, Australia, I'm not sure if people have been to Perth, Australia, but it's small. It's all kind of, you know, it's a little bit of white sand on the beach and then just all like red, dry desert in the hinterlands. And I remember putting it down as my first choice based on, you know, he was like, oh, Perth is so fun and great. And when I didn't, you know, pre-internet, I didn't do any research. And when I landed in the plane, it was like, I was like, oh my gosh, what have I done?
I'm back in Kelowna in a dry version of Kelowna, small
town.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. The desert is in your DNA. You can never get away.
What was the university exchange focus? I mean, you don't just say, I'd like to go to Australia for a while. Through university, you have to do something there that's considered academically relevant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you actually just take courses. The universities have these exchange programs where you just complete coursework at a partner university, and it counts towards your degree program. So it's a pretty straightforward process. They've really made it very easy for students to take advantage of it.
What did going to a country very far away from Kelowna, Canada, and climatically different and in many ways culturally similar, but with some significant differences as well.
Yeah.
What did that do to your sort of perspective on things? The world you're interested in, the way the world is and how it's going?
You know what? I've always been very independent, and I actually went away to boarding school when I was in high school for a while, actually in the States. So I think for me, it was just full of excitement. Australia is quite similar to Canada. There's not a big culture shock. They speak English. It's all the same foods. And I'd say, you know, from a kind of societal values perspective, there are certainly some differences there that have become probably more pronounced over the years, especially from Western Canada. But when I went there, it was just very accessible and easy. And I think for other individuals who maybe, you know, if it was their first trip away or something, it maybe would have been more eye-opening. But for me, it was just kind of, it was just a, you know, kind of just a normal life event.
The way life normally goes.
Yeah.
You'd also been involved back in Vancouver. You'd been involved in some kind of activism with respect to things like the arms race and some of the issues of the day. Was that something that in Vancouver or even in Australia, that was that a current that flowed through your life, this notion of examining what we do and saying, well, we got to do some things differently on a grand scale?
Yeah, I think that's probably like the main current that has really shaped my career path. And I think it really boils down to that kind of seeking justice, really seeking to make things more equitable, to look for collaborative solutions. I mean, the arms race was more, you know, in international relations, you know, at that time, a lot of the focus when I was doing my degree was on, you know, like nuclear armament and all of these types of kind of, you know, situations that require really broad solutions that really, you know, humans aren't that good at. And I found that really fascinating. And certainly from a climate change perspective, which is what I work in now, it's really a similar thing. I mean, we need really global cooperation on a scale that humans have really never been able to manage previously. And I feel like, you know, that was what I was attracted to when I was studying international relations. It was largely focused on kind of power politics and war. But, you know, climate change, all of the same factors are at play there. And when I went to Australia, I mean, some of the things they struggle with there that I found, that I was drawn to were they have a lot of issues with people coming, migrants coming on boats, and you know, they put them in detention centers, and it's all very harsh in my opinion. And I found it, it was all very, you know, I'm kind of always drawn to that, to those types of human problems. And I think with the work I do, kind of what I realized as I was going through my career, and particularly when I left broadcasting, is that I had to, you know, to be really like happy in my soul, I had to be applying myself to problems that matter, not kind of selling, you know, movie tickets through radio stations.
Right. I think that sounds like a mantra for what we would tend to call millennials, that there are many jobs available, but a job that has meaning to you personally and resonates with your own values is really important. It's interesting. In the early 80s, I was involved with the peace movement, and the first conference I attended was the only one I wanted to attend, was the first conference where Russian and American political and military leaders actually came to the same conference to start talking to each other. It sounds like that was something, this kind of collaborative ideal was very much part of your thinking then and of course, in your current work as well.
Yeah, I think it's just such an interesting kind of human problem, right? The things, I mean, it's the same problems that we face when we think about, you know, managing resources, how we manage the environment, and, you know, that we do things individually that have these really large impacts on society and create these negative impacts that really aren't measured in any meaningful way through our economy. And I think from a, you know, kind of, nuclear armament perspective, those types of things, actions that nations take to make themselves safer really destabilize the whole system. And it's the same, you know, you can take that lens and apply it to a whole bunch of global problems.
Speaking of global, climate change. Well, which was what I was going to get onto, climate change back in the early 2000s was becoming an issue, but it was still not as front and center as it has become in the last 5 or 10 years. And food has, which had been so much part of your life, is very much implicated in both the problem and finding solutions to climate change. Maybe you can sort of spin those together a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, the kind of food climate nexus. I mean, obviously, agriculture is, you know, bearing the brunt of climate change, and that, you know, you go and talk to agricultural producers and you know, they've noticed what's happened in the last 20 years. Anyone that's been producing for any reasonable period of time can tell you, you know, what's happened in the last couple of decades and how things are changing and the volatility in the system. And it's interesting. So from that perspective, certainly, you know, from an adaptation perspective, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the agriculture sector to ensure that everyone's positioned to still be producing, you know, 10, 20 years into the future. And on the flip side of that, we've got all of these kind of conversations going on around, you know, emissions reductions, around intensive farming practices, just around kind of the, you know, how we create food and whether it's done sustainably. I think a lot of that is informed by the States. And it's very different here.
Harmony, along with marrying an Australian, you had two children. And when it's well recognized in the environmental world that when you look at the demographics of people who care about climate change, the most engaged group is mothers with small children. Do you sense that this played into how you were shaping your plans for the future, having children and realizing how vulnerable they were?
Certainly. I mean, it sounds so cliche, but I think it's true. I think I left kind of broadcasting before I had kids, but when I was going back to work after having kids, I contemplated going back to broadcasting, and that was when I really, you know, was reflecting on, you know, what type of work is going to have meaning for me? What am I going to do to ensure that, you know, I'm kind of doing my part to you know, improve whatever little things I can improve. I think particularly with climate, as I learned more about it, I went back to do a master's degree right after having kids. And that was where I really kind of got, well, I learned a lot more about climate change and really recognized that there wasn't anything else I could focus on because it was so important. And I think it's almost existential for a lot of individuals. It's really frightening. And I will say, I look at a lot of climate change projections for British Columbia, and frankly, looking out into the 2080s is terrifying. Talking to experts about all different, you know, ecological systems and just all, you know, just how we build our world, the vulnerability of our infrastructure. I look at my children and kind of what they're going to be dealing with in 40 years, and I'm scared for them. It's you know.
How did you marry food into your new way of looking at things? Because obviously you took your master's degree in agricultural economics at UBC, graduated in 2014, and it was right in the heart of this, in the Faculty of Land and Food Systems, which is an interesting name change because it used to be agriculture, but now it's Land and Food Systems. So it's actually defining what you were always interested in, the systems, the overall picture.
Yeah. The Agricultural Sciences Department changed their name to Land and Food Systems, but certainly before I went back to do my master's. And I think it was really to start to, encompass food as a system, not just as the agricultural sciences tend to focus it on, like, just kind of specific, like soil science and agricultural economics in the traditional sense. So this was much broader. And I was really attracted. I was certainly really attracted to food systems in general. Having farmed for several years. It's always been a big part of my life. Also very interested in environmental economics, which is kind of similar to, the program I completed, had a large environmental economics component to it, which you can certainly use that lens to look at food production as well. So I think I actually completely forgot what the question
well,
was.
Well, maybe I can rephrase it by coming from a different angle. Did you, in your coursework, learn about the ecological footprint, the concept developed at UBC? Mm-hmm. Because it's a way to sort of focus thinking on agricultural economics. In fact, it's called ecological economics. William Reese, the professor now retired at UBC, was a leader in developing the concept, but also the whole notion of tying in economic development to ecological sensitivity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of work to do there. So it's interesting in that there's a lot of, certainly the stuff I focused on in my master's was looking at things like, the carbon footprint of food and all of that. What's very apparent when you start to do that is that it's actually immensely complex to calculate those numbers in any type of meaningful way. You really have to do it on a farm by farm basis. They have different inputs. They have different methods of production. And ultimately a lot of it actually has to do with the consumer at the end of the day and how the consumer opts to go and get their food. There's some interesting research about, the carbon footprint of buying kiwis from Australia, or sorry, from New Zealand. And it really, like, the kind of most of the carbon actually comes from whether you drive your car to the store and how much you're buying when you're at the store. So if you're just buying 5 kiwis, it's a lot. If you're buying a whole bunch of other items, the carbon footprint of the entire kind of food basket is
huge.
Less. And often food travels by ship. So that is one of the more carbon efficient methods of transportation. So I think what really struck me in doing my master's was that it's very complex and it's hard. Everybody just wants an answer and like a very kind of simple number that they can reference and use as a heuristic to make, good decisions. And it's very difficult to come up with those numbers and that have any type of real meaning to them. So kind of the workaround often is that you buy from your local farmer, you go to the farmer's market, you do what you can in that way.
What you said earlier was that it was farmers, and getting to the complexity of the issue is one part of, but also knowing that it's a genuine issue is another part. And you saw from farmers that they had a lived experience that was part of their experience of climate change. How did that play into the looking at the bigger picture? Do you remember some of the examples that came to mind at that time that showed why farmers were so vulnerable to climate change?
It's really just kind of because so much farming happens out in the open, right? I mean, it's out in fields. And so when you're reliant on natural inputs, on rain, dry land farming, you're reliant on rainfall and so on. So I think just it's, that was more experience that came from my work with the Climate and Agriculture Initiative. And that, I've talked to thousands of agricultural producers across the province over the past 6 years. And it's really, it's really eye-opening. There's certainly differences in regions as to the types of challenges people are facing on their farms, but there's also a lot of commonalities. And I think it's just more, I think the agriculture sector, and I think particularly the cattle sector, gets thrown under the bus to a certain extent, because when we think of cattle, if you're not in farming, when you think of livestock production, you tend to think of like the movies you see that come out of the States, and there's really not, there's no real kind of parallel as to what happens in British Columbia and how we produce cattle. And so I think when you actually get out and talk to people, you really realize that, you know, these are like everyday challenges for producers. They're trying to figure out how to manage through this. There's limited support from government. Or I guess compared to the amount of support that's needed, there is support from government, but there's a big gap there. And it's just kind of trying to figure out how to like move that machine forward a little bit.
That is an issue that is obviously part of the preoccupations you've developed yourself, but it's also widespread now. I think a recognition that holistic solutions are necessary. You can't just come at it from one angle. You called yourself, when Shelley Corbin, our esteemed researcher for the program, was interviewing you, you said to her that you were a Jill of all trades. And I wonder if having a broad experience has been absolutely central to your work, not just with the Climate and Agriculture Initiative, but sort of the direction you've been going in your explorations, if you like.
Yeah, it's an interesting conundrum, and I'm sure people can relate to this. Generally you either become super specialized in one field, an expert in your field, or you end up just kind of doing a lot of different things. And I have been someone who tends to do a lot of different things. I mean, I work basically in planning to a certain extent, and I work on all of these different topics, from wildfire to water regulations to riparian management, and it's interesting because sometimes I have to develop these projects, and I have to do all this research and kind of try and get myself up to speed on things and talk to people, and I often feel that I don't know enough, and it's a challenging kind of environment to live in your head all the time, to think, I'm developing these projects, I'm responsible for the outcomes of these projects, and I don't fully, I am not the expert here. I don't always know what the answer is. I don't have, the right prescription. So it does sow some doubt on occasion, and you definitely have to rely on asking a lot of questions and seeking out answers wherever you can. But it definitely creates, it's interesting. I don't want to be a Jill of all trades. I'd rather be an expert, but for some reason I always just gravitate back to the broad, the general.
Well, if it's of any interest to you to know, the medical world declared family medicine, which used to be called general practice, a specialty.
Oh, okay.
And it doesn't mean we're like other specialists, and I am a family physician. It means that holism and a broad perspective requires a certain kind of expertise, which is not always found in the work of somebody who does a very narrow focus. Now, you also said you've spoken to literally thousands of individual people involved in food production, in growing, in living on the land and working on the land. I suspect that has also made it very hard for you to see that there's just one way of looking at things, that there's, the right answer to the question, that there may be multiple answers to a question, that kind of way of looking at the world.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of the kind of problems that I'm focused on through my work are, they are kind of problems that have multiple solutions. They are that require multiple solutions. So often we're kind of tasked with trying to identify, what's the best solution for this point in time? Where can we build momentum? So it's certainly, I think, if you go out and you talk to 100 different people, there's going to be some parallels, and people are going to bring up the same ideas, but often there is a lot of, there's a lot of different ideas. There's some really fantastic ideas. There's also innovative ideas and ideas that are very practical at this point in time. And sometimes you're often kind of looking at, is this a stepwise process? Do we need to do this first to get to this point? Or are we at the point where we really just need to be looking at innovative options, because by the time we're into implementation, it's going to be 10 years down the road and this is what we're going to need. So it's very interesting.
You completed your studies in 2014, your master's degree. Mm-hmm. What was the path from there to the Climate and Agriculture Initiative?
So when I went back to do my master's, I was very unsure about whether it was the right decision. It turns out it was the best decision. Part of my master's degree, we had to do a kind of capstone project, thesis type project, and I had applied to go do some work for the Ministry of Agriculture's Climate Division. They had a kind of co-op research position. So I had applied to that, and I did get an offer to go do that. But during that same period of time, I had an opportunity to go work with the Fisheries Economics Research Unit at UBC, sort of the UBC Fisheries Center, to do an economic analysis on the impacts of a tanker spill in the Burrard Inlet. So looking at the economic impacts if there were. So this is part of the City of Vancouver's, they had intervener status in the Trans Mountain Pipeline application. So during the National Energy Board hearings. So this piece of work was actually submitted with that application. And it was working with one of the kind of top fisheries economics researchers at UBC. So I ended up doing that instead of going to work with the Ministry of Agriculture, but it just so happened that connection led me to the Climate and Agriculture Initiative. So it worked out perfectly.
Climate is very much affected by transporting of fossil fuels and the use thereof. So Harmony, you've completed a study of a tanker spill in Burrard Inlet, which for most of us would be an enormous disaster. Mm. Food has played a big role in your life up to this point of your life, back in 2014. Climate change, broadcasting and sharing ideas, it almost seems like you didn't have any choice. You had to start doing something where you were going to get a job that worked on all of those issues, and it seems like that's what's happened. How did you walk up to the office of the director and say, I want a job, I've been training for this all my life? Or did you come across her in some serendipitous way that most of us do?
Yeah, you know what, it was actually thanks to a lovely individual who worked at the Ministry of Agriculture. So the individual who had received my application for the co-op. And when I couldn't do the co-op position, he said, well, I should introduce you to Emily McNair, who manages the Climate and Agriculture Program. She's looking for someone to just help with a small little contract. They had a project going on in the Fraser Valley. I was living in North Vancouver. It was, you know, very accessible.
A small little contract.
Well, it was just a small – so I do work on a contract always, but I started with just a small – I think it was, you know, maybe a four-month contract to just support a workshop series where we were – developing an agricultural adaptation plan for the Fraser Valley. So I met with Emily, and we had a great meeting. I met with her again, and that was that. So it started with this one project, and then they had funding to do more work. So I was working then part-time for the Climate and Agriculture Initiative. I was also actually working out at UBC part-time. And then over time, I've now I'm full-time with the Climate and Agriculture.
So what was that one little project? I was thinking of that sort of fateful.
Yeah.
As she opened the door, little did she know that this would change the course of her life, something of that nature.
Right?
So what's the
project?
Well,
sometimes it makes it sometimes manageable when it's just, you know, because it's not like a full commitment. It's one little, you're like, I can say yes for 4 months. I've got time to do that. So the project was to go into the Fraser Valley with the climate change projections for the region. And we host a workshop series with producers, so very kind of focused, facilitated sessions to really look at the climate change projections, talk about what that will mean for production systems in the area, and then brainstorm, you know, what we've got to do to start to build some adaptive capacity. So in the Fraser Valley, there's a lot of more intensive livestock operations. Obviously, a lot more precipitation expected with climate change. So a lot of conversations around nutrient management, drainage. A lot of the farms in the region have large drainage ditches that are full of invasive species, but also have species at risk. So you can see immediately that we're dealing with policy, regulation, multiple jurisdictions, and that sometimes the municipal governments have regulations that overlap with, you know, when you have species at risk in aquatic areas, you're often dealing with DFO and the federal government. So, I mean, immediately these problems that we have identified become quite complex. So anyways, we basically did these workshops and we write up an adaptation plan, and then that gets turned into a series of projects over time. So I worked with them just on the workshops and plan development.
So what did you actually do? I mean, maybe describe one of the the workshops, what it was like. Yeah. You had farmers, presumably many of whom were interested but not necessarily knowledgeable. Some of the things that you would be talking about would be quite different. Some of these drainage ditches, for example, which had runoff in them, which was not necessarily beneficial in its final destination. There would be all sorts of things like that that could be challenging. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, it was, I mean, fascinating. I'd say out of all of the work that I do, getting into a room full of producers and talking about climate change is you know, definitely my favorite. It is when we do these workshop series, they tend to be quite intense, and that we're often on the road, we're traveling, we're putting on multiple workshops, multiple days in a row. So it's tiring, but it's just so interesting. And you get so many good ideas, and just, you know, people give up their day to come and talk to you and share their ideas. I mean, it's really just it's service at the most basic level. So the conversations generally went. So we would bring in the climate change projections. We worked with the Pacific Climate Impacts Consortium, which is based in Victoria. They are the provincial authority on climate change. So they take the projections from the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change. There's only a few computers in the world that can generate these global climate models and projections. So PCIC in Victoria takes this information and they scale it down for British Columbia. And then we work with them to get very kind of precise projections for smaller regions. So in this case, the Fraser Valley. So we bring these in, we create infographics and kind of make them that information a lot more accessible. And then we just talk about what it means. So what does it mean for, you know, so in the Fraser Valley, there's lots of dairy. There's some livestock, there's market gardens, like vegetables. There's berries, like lots of blueberries, lots of raspberries, chickens. We get all these people together, all these different production systems, and really look for, to prioritize what the key impacts are that they're concerned about. So, you know, in the Fraser Valley, there was a lot of concern about increasing precipitation because there's a lot more water coming. There's also, however, during the summer, a far greater likelihoods of extended periods of dryness and drought. So that's kind of, even though overall in the year you might have more water, in the period where you need it, there's likely to be less. So we kind of just talk about, you know, within the region, really what they want to focus on. So there's kind of a 3 workshop process. And the third workshop, we really get into identifying strategies. So, you know, looking at what's just really urgent that we need to do right now? What's something, you know, do we need to fill some information gaps and do some research to get to the next step? Or possibly there's other organizations that have some momentum and some funding to do work, and we can support that work and move things forward a little bit more quickly. So we basically just work with producers in the region to kind of craft the roadmap, so to say.
We're getting closer to the end of the show, and I wanted to have you outline sort of a snapshot of the CAIBC, the Climate and Agriculture Initiative for BC, just the way it's set up and the basic role that it plays.
Yeah, so we are technically a program that's run by the BC Egg Council. So the British Columbia Agricultural Council, they represent, you know, like 30 different agriculture organizations in British Columbia. So back in about 2008, they through their board and their membership really determined that, you know, climate change was a really big problem. It's happening. We as an agricultural sector need to start to get organized so that we can advocate for funding, so that we can create some programs and supports for producers. So the BC Egg Council houses our program and also the Environmental Farm Plan program, which both provide, you know, pretty significant supports to the agriculture sector. And we started off by going around the province. This is before my time, but really kind of figuring out from an adaptation perspective, you know, how do we tackle this issue? Like, British Columbia is enormous. I mean, there's countries in the world that are as big as British Columbia. How do we start to address climate change adaptation in British Columbia? Can we do it for the whole province? Do we have to do it regionally? How do we account for different production systems and all of that? So kind of the model we've ended up with is this regional model. So now we work, currently we're working in 8 different regions of the province. Each area that we work in, we start by going into the region and doing an extensive kind of engagement workshop series with producers to really identify what the problems are, where the, you know, what the path forward is. And then through the Canadian Agricultural Partnership, we have funding in place after the plan is completed to carry out a handful of projects in the region. So generally each region gets about $300,000 plus whatever we can leverage from other funders. And that's normally enough to carry out, you know, 4 to 8 projects, depending on the scale of those projects.
I understand that this region, the Columbia-Shuswap Regional District, is not yet in under the aegis of the CAIBC.
Yeah, we unfortunately have not been able to write a plan yet for Columbia-Shuswap. The funding comes in 5-year cycles, and during the last funding cycle, we did write new plans for the Kootenays, including Boundary, for Vancouver Island, and also for Belfina, Chaco, Fraser, Fort George. So we were able to write some new plans with the last round of funding, but we didn't get to all of them. So unfortunately, Columbia-Shuswap, Thompson-Nicola still doesn't have a plan, and Metro Vancouver as a whole also doesn't have a plan. And then I guess also there's a bit of production up in kind of the Pemberton, Lillooet area. So there are still some gaps. I'm certainly hopeful that we will be able to fill those in some capacity.
And the goal is to cover the whole province?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately we operate on just a 5-year cycle. So, I mean, we're always optimistic that we're going to get another round of funding, but it's all directed from the government, kind of how they want to distribute those funds. I think there's going to be a significant probably shift in how our program is delivered in the future, because what's happened is as we've worked in all of these regions that were, you know, really, they're really quite different. What we've realized now over the past kind of 10 years is that there are a lot of overlapping problems, and we've created, hundreds of resources for wildfires, for, you know, ditch and drainage management, dugout management, all of, you know, everything you can think of. And a lot of these resources would be very transferable to other parts of the province. Sure. So I think we're probably at a point now where we can scale up a little and deliver some of this, some of these resources and projects at a provincial level, and hopefully still do some regional support as well.
One question is, and we're coming close to the end of the show, is there a plan yet for northeastern BC, the Peace Country? It's kind of a hotbed because it's the grain breadbasket, if you like, of British Columbia, but it's also where most of the fossil fuel extraction activity is going on. Do you yet have a plan for that region?
There is a plan for the Peace. Yes, actually, the Peace was one of the pilot regions. So the Peace was one of the first regions in the province to have a plan. So we've been working up in the Peace for about a decade now. So yeah, there's lots of work going up there.
The process, we're going to, in our next show next week, we'll talk about the nitty-gritty of the process of building up one of these area plans.
Yeah.
But right now, it's clear that climate change is starting to play a bigger and bigger role in individual decision-making, but also in broad decision-making at the larger scale.
Yeah.
Being involved with that, you mentioned that one of your directors had said addressing climate change is difficult, but collaboration is even harder. And so that's something that we're going to be discussing the whole nitty-gritty of collaboration with a lot of different processes. Mm-hmm. Harmony, it's really been wonderful to have you on the show today. I'm looking forward to the next show when we get into some of these other issues. You've really probably stirred a lot of imagination, a lot of listeners starting to realize that there is thought going into how we're going to do things in the future, and that's really what we all need to be thinking about now and in the future too. Thank you very much again.
Thank you. That was wonderful.